You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 20th of July 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24. Coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Gillian DeBias and Sophie Grove.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll be bringing a smile to your face as we look at the latest film releases with Karen Kusanovich. The thread which ties together today's choices is comedy.
What is she doing?
She's looking for my balls.
Hey, if anyone sees the captain's balls, let me know. They're about this big. They're like really, really tiny little girl balls. If little girls had balls.
And continuing the theme of humor, we'll be asking comedy critic Bruce Dessau to give us his take on the French-Canadian axe-juggling Lumberjacks currently performing in London, and to look ahead to the comedy he'll be scouting out at this year's Edinburgh Fringe Festival.
We'll also be welcoming back DJ, producer and label consultant Christopher Tubbs for today's music review and giving you some tips for the weekend from Perth.
It may be the middle of winter in Perth, but unless you think that 19 degrees Celsius is too chilly to leave the house, there are plenty of opportunities to have a good time.
So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. Hello, and indeed a very warm welcome to The Review this Saturday here in London. Welcome, Sophie.
Thank you. Lovely to see you.
Well, I'm feeling so guilty because technically this is a review, but my guilty secret is the weather's been so gorgeous here. I just couldn't bear to go inside to see anything. No galleries, no cinema, no theatre, nothing, Sophie.
It is. It's been so beautiful. It's been a week for parks.
Oh, I know.
And lots of lovely sort of, outside moments, really, sitting in the garden.
But you were so lucky because you just came back from this remote island off Scotland.
I did, and it did have a literary connection. It's the Isle of Jura. It's very, very far up in the Inner Hebrides. It's where George Orwell, who's actually called Eric Blair, wrote 1984 in a little cottage called Barn Hill on the island. It's a really very small, beautiful, wild place, and I stayed in a hunting lodge just about 6 miles from there.
Amazing, though, when you go to an island like that where, such an iconic book and an author, as you're doing your walks, you can just sort of take you back to that time when he was kind of being inspired and writing those.
It was amazing because we had his diaries from the time that he was there. I mean, he took, his diaries were not very literary at all. They're really sort of counting eggs and things and talking about
the banality of life
problems. Yeah. But it was very interesting to kind of be actually looking at these notations from exactly the same day, but in the 1940s when he was penning this amazing work in this beautiful place. And it's such a dystopian work, as we know, but the place is incredibly beautiful. So
I think really there's a place there. I think they do sort of literary fellowships. I think Will Self went on one because it's kind of the remoteness of the island that inspires you to write.
Yes.
Did you do any writing, Sophie?
A little bit of reading, not so much writing. I was swimming. I was lounging.
Excellent. Here's to lounging. You're listening to The Review. We'll be back in a moment.
Well, if you find yourself in a cinema over the coming days, you may well emerge afterwards with a smile on your face. From zombie-filled pub crawl to a cop drama which champions female comedy, there's a host of interesting laugh-out-loud titles currently lighting up our screens.
And to give us her take on some of these new releases, I'm delighted to welcome back critic and review regular Karen Kruzanovich. Hi, Karen.
How are you?
Well, I'm fine, but I feel like dubbing this hour sort of Karen Comedy Hour. You've picked some gems for us.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's summertime. Sorry, I'm going to get near the mic. There we go.
There.
I'm actually very short. Yes, I think when you go into the cinema, you don't really, I don't really want anything heavy right now.
No.
It's summer. I'll deal with the heavy stuff in September. In fact, I was talking to another critic, and he said, "I'm waiting for all the adult movies to come out in September." And I thought he meant adult
naked movies.
And I said, "What? Really? But you're a father. That's disgusting." So no, but he meant that there are some really interesting films coming up, but there are some terrific summer films as well, and they're not all robots. Although I love robots.
You're allowed in summer to
Thank
love
you.
Robots.
I love big, shiny robots.
So it's quite fun. The first one you've picked is part of the Cornetto trilogy.
Isn't that great?
Which is a little bit of a cryptic reference to people who haven't seen this trilogy, but The World's End, very interesting film. What's the Cornetto connection?
The Cornetto connection is that there are three of these, maybe there's going to be more, of Simon Pegg, the actor who I think is getting better and better, and Edgar Wright, the UK director, who actually retweeted me the other day. I just want to tell you that I'm shining my own badge here. This is how they're uniting, calling it the Cornetto trilogy. They're uniting these comedies that are basically building in comedic power, I suppose would be. What did you find out about it?
A cornetto features in each one.
Yeah, well,
a little cornetto moment, but it's Hot Fuzz, it's Shaun of the Dead, these very famous and absolutely hilarious films, and it's a little thread that connects all of them.
I don't look for the cornetto. I know it's there, but I just don't look. And I think that's a good sign. In fact, very quickly, I was talking to Bill Forsyth the other day, who's the director of Local Hero, and he's saying in one scene, Burt Lancaster's tie color changes, but you don't notice it because the movie is so good. Well, he doesn't say that. I say that.
Continuity alert.
Yes, I know. And the wardrobe lady was like, poking her eyes out. But I never noticed the cornettos because, actually, I do remember it now, because the movie is so good. But I think that's very clever.
So this is a sort of a lad's film, really.
Wow.
It's a road trip. Can you give us an insight into kind of how hilarious is it? Is it the funniest of the trilogy?
I think so. But I love the whole trilogy, although Hot Fuzz wasn't my scene. I never, the one thing that I find difficult, even though I've lived in Britain such a long, long time, is the lad culture. I just don't think it's funny. And I think it's got really high mileage now. But he makes this fresh because even though you say it's a lad's movie, and I suppose specifically it is, but we've all been out with a bunch of guys, and when they start goofing off and getting drunker and drunker, as they get in this movie, which is actually, I think, part of the way the plot unfurls, you observe how funny it is.
Let's have a listen to hear where the humor lies.
Our goal that night was simple. 12 pubs, 12 pints. From the first post to the world's end. But that night,
we want to get loaded.
We never made it.
I saw the boys the other day.
Uh-huh.
We're going to go back to Newton Haven.
Why?
5 guys, 12 pubs, 50 pints.
60 pints.
Steady on, you Alky.
This is our chance to finally finish what we started.
We are going to do the Golden Mile, and this time,
we are going to see it through to the bitter end. Or lager end.
Good evening, Raimondo. The prodigal son's return.
Hi. What do you recommend?
Beer.
Mmm.
One tap water.
What?
That was a clip from The World's End. Karen, I hate slapstick, but I kind of have a feeling I would laugh out loud in the cinema.
I think you would. You know, if there's so many. Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg have written a really good script, really pacey. It falls down a little bit at the end, but I'm being super critical now. It's got different layers of comedy. There's slapstick for the people that, really aren't going to get the finer points for whatever reason. And then there's also some really incisive, funny. I mean, I laughed really loud at least twice.
And some of the characters are a bit excruciating. This Gary King, who's the protagonist, played by Simon Pegg, they're saying he sort of peaked. They're very teenage sort of men, in a way. Somebody was saying he's a horrific cross between Neo from The Matrix and David Brent from The Office.
That's very, that's
astute. Sounds like an awful combination. But is he likable? What's this protagonist like?
Well, I don't want to give too much away because as his personality reveals itself as the film goes along. But ultimately, this is a man that never moved out of the 90s, and really almost literally, from his car to his musical taste, he's still listening to cassettes. Everything people go, oh yeah, I remember, I made that for you. No, this is the one you made for me, the mixtape. So this is the guy who's defending the peak of his life, basically. And we've seen that in films before, for example, in Friday Night Lights, the guy that thinks that his, the peak of his life was playing, high school football. So this isn't unusual. But how his character progresses, and I don't want to say any more because I'll give too much away, but he is excruciating, but also lovable in kind of a tragic way. Tragico-comic.
Well, on the topic of comic, we're going to go to your next choice. The Heat. Now, this sort of panned by critics, and yet it's doing phenomenally well.
Yeah, you know, this is a problem. This is the critical audience divide. There's a better phrase for it, but I can't remember what it is. This has also happened with Adam Sandler's Grown Ups 2, where the audience liked it and the critics just wanted to kill themselves. So,
And which side do you lie?
Well, you know, I'm more of an audience member, really, because even though I get to go to movies for free, I do, I don't forget what it's like to pay to go and see it. I don't forget what it's like to have to look and decide what to go and see and which of your friends you're going to believe is, you know.
The word of mouth.
Yeah. This is like Bridesmaids, only with a cop twist. I mean, it's written by a debut film writer. A woman, Sophie. I'm going to get a name wrong here, but I'll carry on. And if you liked Bridesmaids and you like that kind of in-your-face humor, and also the kind of humor that Melissa McCarthy is dishing out at the minute, a lot of swearing, really, really full on, and a lot of, if somebody said what she said to you in person, you would call the police. You know, really, it's really because she's very, very threatening and very aggressive. But in this setting, it's funny. And I can't imagine anybody but Sandra Bullock being able to foil this, because she's not only a physically big woman, which means she takes up more space on the screen. She seems physically sort of like she could take you out if she wanted to. She also is personality-wise just fearless.
And how does the cop genre work with women? It's quite quite unusual to have a female cop drama.
Yeah, it is.
And actually quite good news in a way, because we see so many... Yeah. Male duos in you know, driving around solving crimes. Is this a really nice twist in a way?
Well, I mean, it's not much of a twist. I mean Paul Feig, I should say his name, F-E-I-G, please tell me how to say it. He says, "I don't like women acting like men. That's not serving anybody. That's why The Heat was more important to me." And that's a quote that he said what drew him to directing the film, because he actually walked away from doing Bridget Jones 3 to do this. Which I probably shouldn't have said on the air, but never mind. It's a twist insofar as we can see that, okay, I don't know how you feel about being a woman, but sometimes I feel you have to be too nice all the time and you don't want to be nice anymore because nobody else is being nice. Just because you're wearing a dress, you have to be nice. So really, it kind of takes that. Melissa McCarthy is saying, she's playing this character who really is, I don't want a real woman. What does that mean? That means she swears, she drinks, she punches people out, she steals things, you know, but she still has, and crazily enough, she still has men coming up to her in the street saying, "Hey, I didn't see you after that first night."
Well, we have a clip, so let's have a listen.
We got a situation in Boston. I'm sending you up.
FBI, we recently got intel that you brought in a dealer, Terrell Rojas.
Look who's here!
Detective Mullins isn't back from lunch yet.
I'm sure he won't mind.
Well, he's a she.
Oh, it's on! She's crazy!
I'm Special Agent Sarah Ashburn. Are you about to be interrogated by an officer?
I am an officer, and that's my perp.
Could you just close the door on the way out?
I'll shut the door on you. Will you lay down here, put your head in the door, and I'll slam it about 157,000 times.
Aw, girl, you better run.
Melissa McCarthy and Sandra Bullock in The Heat. Do you think it's run its course in one film, or will we be seeing Heat 2?
I think we'll probably be seeing Heat 2. I don't know how long her shtick is going to hold out, Melissa McCarthy, but, you know, it's shticks have worked for people like Ricky Gervais, so who am I to say? But it is, if I can use that very 90s word, empowering, it is.
And Sandra Bullock is just so funny in so many films. I think I love the way she can morph so easily into these roles. She is very successful. I mean, my grandmother loved Sandra Bullock. I do. I think she's one of those people that actually just has so much longevity.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely right. She can do anything. I mean, in this, she transforms herself almost immediately in front of your eyes. She looks amazing. I mean, you see, she's had a little work, but, you know, hey, what the heck? She's got to stay on the road. But she's got enough security to be an effective foil for Melissa. I mean, other actresses would have been just steamrolled. And I think, you know, I came out, I was standing in the lobby of the theater, and the guy said, another critic said to me, "God, I really hated that. What did you think?" And I said, "I'm going to go to dinner." I didn't want to say, "I actually liked it," because I'm such a wimp.
Well, moving off comedy a little bit. Now, this is a film that's just opened here to rave reviews, and I'm actually trying to book tickets for tonight. It premiered, I think, at the Venice Film Festival, and it's a film by a first-time female director in Saudi Arabia, and the film's called Wajja. Why are people so excited, other than the fact that she is a female filmmaker coming out of Saudi Arabia?
Well, I'm all for women or men making first features in difficult circumstances, and that's wonderful, and people do that. But it's particularly nice when it's a terrific film. In fact, this is a breakthrough film. I mean, Wajda is very pro female in an area where it's difficult to be pro female. And this Wajda is a 10-year-old girl studying in Riyadh. And she's dreaming of this bicycle. I don't want to tell you too much because if I tell you too much, you won't want to go. And then, and she, you know, her mother is too worried that her father's going to take a second wife, so it doesn't really get enough attention. She's kind of a naughty girl in a way, but she discovers that she can get cash to this bicycle by entering a Quran competition. And she's not, you know, good pious girl, but she transforms herself to achieve her dreams. That's not giving away the ending, by the way. But it's wonderful, inspirational. Your heart goes out to her. And another thing that I love is that it shows us that, you know, cultures, we've got more in common than we do apart.
And quite interesting that the tone is more satirical than dramatic, which is kind of an unusual tone for this type of genre. I think that also increases this idea of that we do have so much in common with these hopes and dreams, and very good for exposing what life really is like in contemporary Riyadh. Do you think that tone is something very original?
I think it is original. I also think it's very carefully, very nimbly done, because we've seen satire go awry many, many times in less delicate hands. And I think it's very easy to mistake that, particularly if you don't recognize the cultural points that the filmmaker's trying to make. But in this, in Wajda, it's actually very clear.
Well, it's already being tipped for possible contender for Best Foreign Film Oscar. So Absolutely. It may not be the easiest film to find, but I encourage everyone to go.
Please.
And have a look. Karen Krasanovich, thank you as ever for joining us here on The Review. We'll be back next to take our weekly cultural tip around the world, courtesy of our Toronto Bureau Chief.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Sophie Grove, and Gillian DeBias. It's that time of the week again when our Toronto Bureau Chief, Nelly Gotcheffer, unearths some cultural highlights for us around the world. Let's hear what the coming days have to offer.
If in Japan this weekend, here is an idea for how to spend your time. Browse the works of over 200 artists while strolling through the islands of the Satoshi region. We recommend a visit to the Ogijima Island, where on display are the surreal sculptures of Keisuke Yamaguchi. Satoshi Art Festival is at various venues across the Satoshi region until the 1st of September. Out now at cinemas across the UK is American director Drake Doremus's latest art house drama, Breathe In. Music teacher Keith Reynolds sees his family shaken to the core by the arrival of a British exchange student. The main characters are played by our all-time favourite Australian, Guy Pearce, while Doremus's favourite leading lady, Felicity Jones, steps in as the young temptress. Breathe In is now playing at various cinemas across the UK. In Paris, Maison Européenne de la Photographie plays host to the first ever exhibit of photos by French filmmaker Costa Gavras. Entitled Carnet Photographique, the collection of 70 black and white images spans from locations in Palestine, Russia, New York and Latin America and captures political events, Mitterrand's death, street protests in New York, alongside personal portraits of Costa Gavras' family. Carnet Photographique is on until the 15th of August. The latest edition of the annual Russian Resurrection Film Festival rounds up in Canberra this weekend. Be sure not to miss Pavel Ruminov's I Will Be Near, playing on Saturday at Palace Electric Cinema. The family drama won the grand prize at the Sochi Open Russian Film Festival last year. For more details, go to RussianResurrection.com. And this weekend, we'll be heading to Portland for the PDX Pop Now Music Festival. Taking to the stage on Saturday is a spread of sounds that range from the Afrobeat of Dusut Mali to the classic songwriting of alt country act Richmond Fontaine. And now let's hear a little taste. This is Richmond Fontaine with Out of State.
Shut the curtains.
For Monocle, from Toronto, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
Put a blanket over them. You don't need to see that today. We'll come back here. Let's clear and safe. Don't worry.
And that was Richmond Fontaine with Out of State there, ending that report by Nelly Gotcheva.
And it's time now for our weekly music review. And as you may have heard, we're having something of a heat wave here in London. It's been too hot for anything too strenuous. So we're taking the tempo down to something more leisurely. And we're joined in the cool of the studio by DJ, producer and music consultant Christopher Tubbs. Once again, hello, Christopher. Welcome to the review.
Hello, ladies. Nice to be here.
I'm curious, you know, like how I always think that when you have al fresco dining and it's hot, food tastes different and better in the heat and outdoors. Is it the same with music?
I think it is. I think it definitely is. I mean, it's a funny thing because track tempo is one of these subjects that is constantly natted about amongst DJs and producers and back rooms. You know, what is the perfect tempo? And generally the consensus is 120, bizarrely, which is 120 beats per minute, which is actually, you know, it's your heartbeat and it's the tempo of house music. But I think in summer, when your heartbeat slows down and, in fact, all of your kind of anatomical functions are operating a little bit more slowly, it's nice to kind of immerse yourself in something slow and languid and warm and tropical.
I love that little insight into what producers talk about in the green room. Yeah. It's almost, that is anatomical. It's almost surprising. But tell us what you really are listening to this week. It is a little bit more languid in London, even if you want the sort of urban heart of things.
It is.
What is your sort of top track for this time of year?
That's quite a big question. I think it's more tonality. It's more what you're kind of feeling in terms of sounds and instruments, and I think this time of year, as Carnival is only a month away, I think it's all about bass. Mm. That's what it's about. you know, it's not so much stuff you hear as you feel in your diaphragm.
Well, you were talking about the beat of the heartbeat, but something like Carnaval, you actually feel it. You
that's
know,
right.
Last night in the East End, people were spontaneously just setting up little sort of sound systems in the street and just dancing just out there. Yeah, and I it felt like something out almost like something that was staged for but it's quite interesting how spontaneously people sort of gather and the tempo does change. And there's a lot of bass in the East End last night as I was wandering around.
Well, you've curated a little kind of playlist for us today.
Yeah.
Your first track is The Horrors. Can you tell a little bit about them and why you've chosen that?
The Horrors are a four-piece from Southend-on-Sea. And they are as much known, if I was to be unkind, for their kind of media party antics as they are for their music. But if I were to be kind, I would say they're also enormous contributors to not only major label pop music, but also left field kind of interesting, niche little releases that they, aside from their major label contracts, they do on little vinyl-only labels in London, like Dissident Records. So they're really, really passionate about interesting, different sounds. And this particular track is remixed by a New Zealander, keeping it very much... I'm representing hard here. It's a producer called Conan Moccasin from Auckland. And he's really forged a career for himself over here in recent times. This is a remix of Still Life, and it's got a kind of hazy, almost like you're listening it through gauze of some kind. It's sort of blurred and out of focus, and it's modern reggae, I guess, for the 21st century.
Let's have a listen. Horrors with Still Life, the music choice of our guest reviewer today, Christopher Tubbs. I love the languid feel to that. Now, is that something you just should listen to on great stereo system, or would you hear that live?
I think it's a stereo system thing. I don't think you could do that live because it's basically they've slowed down and sped up the recording just slightly, so it gives it a strange narcotic sort of lean. You know, I don't think you could do that live. If you can do that live, I think the viewer, whoever's watching that live, it might be in his head more than actually what's going on stage. I think, yeah.
There's something that is that. Almost the beauty in it is the floor, that kind of slightly, is it kind of stilted feeling?
Yeah.
Like, almost like you're stuck in mud or something.
That's exactly it. Exactly it. It's almost like a slight seasickness.
Yeah, I know. Hopefully people, Londoners won't be listening to too much of that in the heat. It might send them all a bit funny. But let's talk to you about the Daft Punk album, because, I mean, my gosh, it has just been so hyped and so talked about, you know, as this idea of the summer music, which possibly is a sort of over-discussed topic, really. But do you think that it's been worth all the hype?
I think whenever you talk about the Daft Punk album now, people sort of let out a sigh of exasperation. And kind of, oh, God, have we not been here already, you know? But the thing is that what it is, if you strip it all, if you strip away all of the commercialism and the, you know, the incredible marketing campaign, let's face it, was an amazing marketing campaign. I can't remember an anticipation for a record like it in the last decade. And that is actually because it, you know, it reflects an old school big money marketing campaign of the mid-70s or something like that. Billboards, teasers, you know. I mean, take away the online aspect of it. And that's what it was. It was very, very old school. And that also is really where the album's coming from. It's a couple of guys who have perhaps one of the few electronic music outfits still existing in the record industry who have made some money in the last 10 years. And they have basically paid for this incredibly exorbitant production, mainly by themselves. Mm. You know, the record label's only doing a distribution job, essentially. So they're like children in a candy store. They've gone in there, they've hired the best session musicians, the best producers, and the best studio in LA and New York, you know, where some of the greatest names in contemporary music from the last 100 years have recorded their albums. And they've just gone wild, you know. So it resonates with a lot of people because it just, there's so much love in that record. There's so much passion and it's so uncompromising, which is the greatest thing about it.
Well, you've chosen to play Doing It Right, Daft Punk. Let's have a listen.
That's how you know the magic's right.
Doing it right. Everybody will be dancing and we're feeling it right. Everybody will be dancing and be doing it right. Everybody will be dancing and we're feeling it right. Everybody will be dancing tonight, doing it right. Everybody will be dancing and we're feeling it right. Everybody will be dancing and be doing it right. Everybody will be dancing and we're feeling it right. Everybody will be dancing and we're feeling it right. Everybody will be dancing and we're feeling it right. Everybody will be dancing and we're feeling it right. Everybody will be dancing and we're feeling it right.
Daft Punk with Doing It Right, the choice of Christopher Tubbs, our reviewer of the day. Christopher, you work as a consultant as well, matching music to brands.
Mm-hmm.
Is Daft Punk the kind of desirable sort of group that companies want to get in bed with?
I think right now, companies, brands would basically steer well clear of them unless they're willing to spend an absolute fortune on licensing, because I think Daft Punk right now just represents horrifying cost to any brand, you know. Mm. But in terms of tonality and how it sounds from that kind of classic disco sound of, you know, Nile Rodgers blessed every Daft Punk record with on that album, to that sort of very left field psych indie pop kind of sound that also is represented on that album, I think that is very, very timely. And I think, you know, look, if people are buying records, brands will want to be associated with that hunger. So, yeah.
And that particular track is very, very beautiful, very simple, kind of monastic in a way.
Yes, that's exactly what it is.
And it's quite, I mean, that's the voice of Noah Lennox. He's kind of a choir boy in a way.
Well, yeah.
I really love it. It's kind of very, it's sort of meditative, quite different from the other sort of headline track that we've played.
He's known as Panda Bear from the Animal Collective. And you're quite right. He has a very sort of choir boy like tone, very simple tone, and it really, really works with kind of repeated chorus chants and things like that. And I love it. I love it. It's got a sort of beat that's reminiscent of kind of like a West Coast hip hop beat from the mid noughties, but everything else is this sort of very childlike, has a childlike beauty to it.
You kind of want to be on a beach just literally watching the waves come in and out.
Are we going there? Am I taking you there?
We're there.
Brilliant.
Bags are packed. Your next track is Begin, Elate. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Okay, well, this guy is, Begin is a chap called James Holroyd, who is best known as the Chemical Brothers tour DJ for many, many years, and also the promoter and resident of a very famous northern nightclub called Bugged Out, which rose to prominence in the 90s. And he's best known for sort of being quite kind of banging techno DJ is probably the best way to describe it. But he does a very, very keen little sideline in beautiful Balearic music. And this is his finest moment, I think. It's completely beatless. It's just this beautiful ascending chord sequence, and it, I defy you not to feel a little shiver down your spine as you listen to this record.
Elate by James Holroyd and Begin. It's very another sort of very sort of mood altering yeah. track there. Really takes takes you places. You're quite right.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a funny little thing that, that only came out on 12-inch vinyl. And so I literally, before the show, had to put it on the turntable and record it into my laptop before I send it to you guys. So it's nice to be able to share things like that. And it seems ridiculous to me that there's only 200 copies of that tune literally on record out there. And it's just nice to be able to actually, for more people than those 200 fanatical DJs, be able to hear it, you know.
We feel very privileged to have had a little listen to that. So we're running out of time on the review. So what we're going to have you do is introduce your last track as we say goodbye to you, Christopher Tubbs.
Thank you for having me. This is Walter Hawkins, the track called Metropolis, off the Wilderness America, a Celebration of the Land compilation from 1974.
In the name of progress, do you see us growing cold? Living in the city, all I want is an unused place where my children can find some space to grow. I had some dreams of the country.
Well, we're getting out of the studio now to enjoy this week's City Guide from around the world. Today we're crossing to Perth, and Adrian Craddock is here to help us guide us through some highlights, rather, from the city over the coming days.
It may be the middle of winter in Perth, but unless you think that 19 degrees Celsius is too chilly to leave the house, there are plenty of opportunities to have a good time. Perth is a mining boom town, and much of the city centre is taken up by glass skyscrapers owned by some of the big natural resource players. But if you venture over the so-called Horseshoe Bridge, you can discover North Bridge, a gritty, former red light district in the middle of a resurgence.
Stop that! That's me! What's the matter with you?
I'll tell you what's wrong.
One of the first things you'll see on your approach is the newly built State Theatre. On Saturday, the Black Swan Theatre Company is here opening their latest play, called Other Desert Cities. It's about a Californian author who's preparing to write a memoir about her family's shady past.
My daughter is tap dancing around about this book of hers, and we're all sitting here waiting, pretending nothing is happening.
It's also a good chance to see inside the Heath Ledger Auditorium, named after one of Perth's most celebrated sons. On Sunday, it's worth heading down for a walk along Perth's main tributary, the Swan River. From there, it's easy to spy two of the city's most controversial buildings. One is the Swan Bell Tower, which, you guessed it, is a bell tower that resembles the state's official animal, a swan. The second is the Perth Convention Centre. don't be put off by all the concrete. Inside, you can go along to the final day of the Good Food and Wine Festival. You can sample mango beer from Matzo Brewery in Broome and meet some of the country's most successful culinary exports, including Pete Evans and Maggie Beer. If you follow the river south, you'll find yourself in Fremantle. On Friday, the Fremantle Arts Centre is launching a new exhibition. Anarchy, Rock and Ink. The showing focuses on Bob Cooney, an Australian printmaker who spent 30 years in New York creating political posters. There's also work by Beyond the Pale, the St Kilda-based design studio who've created rock posters for bands like the Rolling Stones, the Beastie Boys and the Black Keys. Nearby, there's also plenty of bars like Mojo's and the Norfolk Basement if you're in the mood to dance. You gotta fight for your right to party! For Monocle in Perth, I'm Adrian Craddock.
You are listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be back next to find out whether axe juggling is worthwhile entertainment.
If design is your beat, then tune into Section D, our weekly show delving deep into the latest developments in the worlds of architecture, fashion, furniture, product development, tech, and many more.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
No matter what the sphere, we'll be here with expert insights, news and exclusive interviews on all things design. So switch on to Section D every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
Welcome back. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review with me, Sophie Grove and Gillian DeBias.
What you're hearing there is the sound of Timber, a French-Canadian performance currently making its UK premiere at London South Bank Centre. But what you can't see is that while the music is playing, a family of lumberjacks are juggling axes, jumping through two men cross-cut saws and performing acrobatic stunts on lengths of timber balanced on people's shoulders.
Timber is the creation of Cirque Alphonse, and here to give us his take on this unusual act is comedy critic of London's Evening Standard and editor of the comedy website Beyond the Joke, Bruce Dessau. Bruce, welcome to The Review.
Hi, hello there.
Hi, great to see you. It sounds like a real riot, this timber, and really just something quite unusual, this kind of lumberjack genre and kind of an amazing circus all in one.
Yes, it's. I've seen a lot of circus. There's been a big sort of boom in circus shows in London recently. I was at Cirque du Soleil a couple of nights ago at the O2 Arena. So circus is really popular. And I've seen a lot, and it's been getting a bit repetitive, but this one is different. I've never seen circus combined with wood chopping before, so it is a fairly unique show, and the music's very evocative, but you really have to see it to get an idea because, yeah, everything, all the props that they use are things that the lumberjacks would use. So obviously, instead of juggling with clubs, they're juggling with axes that you'd normally be chopping bits of timber with. So it's quite a spectacular.
You talk about the Cirque du Soleil, and I suppose it kind of really upped the ante in making circuses almost like kind of cinematic in their special effects and theatrics. This seems the antidote of that, taking it right back.
Yeah, it is. It's more kind of back to basics show. They don't have fantastic special costumes. They just wear checked shirts, and but in terms of skill. I think some of the people, this is actually a family show. It's the Carabinier family from Canada. And I think the son, I think he has worked with Cirque du Soleil. Mm. He's certainly worked with similar people because, again, Cirque du Soleil origins are in Montreal as well. So there's a big sort of connection. But this is a family. And the skills they use, you know, whether it's acrobatics, Cirque du Soleil do a thing on a thing called a Russian bar, which is a springy, long strip of wood. You bounce up and down on it, and Alan Carabinier does this, Antoine does this, but instead of using a strip of they just use timber, they just use something that you might have found, a log that you might have found in a forest, but they're using the same circus skills and acrobatics and leaping and flying over each other, and instead of diving through hoops, they dive through a circular saw, which is pretty scary as well. And all these things are real because they do chop things and cut things with them, so you know they're not fake, they genuinely have very sharp edges.
And it's wonderful that it is such a family outfit. 66-year-old granddad Alain is in it, and also a 2-year-old grandson.
Yeah.
I love that element, and also the fact that they do have this idea of narrative, this sense of Quebec and some of the folklore that goes in to the show. Do you think that it's not just tricks, that there is a sense of theatre here?
There is. I mean, they sort of put it together, and the stage looks good because it looks like they've got a log cabin on one side, they've got the sort of timber yard on the other. Although actually I think the tricks are sort of the best thing about it. Because interesting, they're not, when I went to see it, I thought, oh, this is interesting. They're a family of lumberjacks. They're not actually, they're a family of circus performers who have decided to use this as a sort of backdrop. And similarly, the 66-year-old grandfather, I thought, oh, he must have been a circus performer for 50 years. But actually, he only took up performing about 6 or 7 years ago when it was his children who had been circus performers. And he'd always wanted to be a circus performer. So he decided to learn some tricks himself and join in. And as I said, he's 66 and he flies across the stage on a sort of elasticated bungee and spins around and does some tricks. And then exactly, the grandson Arthur, who is only 2 years old. Obviously, it's going to be a family that continues. He's already does some tricks.
It's interesting circus acts. There is something almost like addictive with certain families that it does. Yeah. It's something that if you are born to a family like that, you carry on the baton.
Yeah, I think you can see the attraction of it. You know, they've kind of grown up with it and naturally the next generation, you know, there were families like this. There are shows, you know, Charlie Chaplin's grandchildren are circus performers all around the world. You know, it's just, whether it's in the blood or in the genetics or just growing up around circus, it's a very seductive, romantic occupation.
And quite wonderful in a way that they're celebrating some of these skills, like wood chopping.
Yeah.
Because actually we featured in the magazine this professional wood chopper from French Canada.
Yeah.
And it's a really big scene. So
oh, yeah.
I think they may be bringing a bit of attention to those guys too.
Yeah, no, it's, and some of the stuff, you know, balancing on logs, which again, you know, I've seen it in movies and I've seen it done on rivers, and they're racing around on stage, balancing, you know, racing each other on stage on logs. It's a skill that actual lumberjacks do use, and they've brought it onto the stage.
And interesting that Cirque du Soleil came from Quebec. Here's another one. And does the music from the region play an important role?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lovely sort of, again, it's this idea of, you know, when you take circus out of the big top and put it onto the stage, you have to turn it into some kind of show and maybe have some kind of narrative. If it is just a succession of, you know, tricks, it wouldn't feel like the same sort of show. So they have music and they have a live band on stage, and one of the daughters, Julie, is a wonderful singer. So she sings about it. Helps if your French is good. My French is a bit rusty these days, so the songs are all in French, but it's about life, you know, life in the backwoods and rural, growing up in rural Canada, and I think that's what makes it it's funny because it's a family on stage and it feels like a show for families as well. There's something there that, you know, your whole family can go and everyone will like some element of it.
It's going to be touring, I think, after the UK. It's going to Europe and Asia. And we turn now to just a sneak preview of the Edinburgh Festival, which is going to be coming up. And the Edinburgh Festival, very highbrow sort of arts. Then there's the Fringe. And within the Fringe, there's comedy. And I know you're going to be covering it. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the things you're going to be scouting.
Yeah, that's my specialty area, stand-up comedy. And I think at the last count, there were about 580 shows to see. I don't know quite how I think I'm going to be up there for about 3 weeks, but it's drinking a lot of coffee, I guess, to stay up very late, start very early and stay very late to try and see as many shows as I can. And that's it. I mean, there really is something for everyone in Edinburgh, whether you like sort of, you know, old-fashioned comedians, new comedians. You know, one of the people I'm looking forward to seeing is, because he's sort of someone from my era that I grew up with, is David Baddiel, who was one of the first big sort of, you know, arena comedians of the 90s. And David Baddiel hasn't really done stand-up. You know, he wrote a movie, The Infidel. He's written novels. And now he's making his comeback doing stand-up. And his show's called Fame, Not the Musical. And it sounds very interesting because it's about this whole culture of celebrity that we live in now and his position in it, because he is one of these people who was very famous at one point and then kind of slipped more into the background. But he's got a lot of famous friends. I think he's got an anecdote in the show about being at Russell Brand's wedding and being backstage with Ricky Gervais and meeting Madonna. And sometimes, you know, he gets recognised at these occasions. Sometimes he doesn't. Sometimes he gets mistaken for Ben Elton. So that's a really interesting show. That's funny, yeah.
And Another one looks quite interesting, Adam Horn. The Horn section.
The Horn's Alex Horn, yeah.
Oh, Alex Horn, sorry. But it's quite wonderful. A man who hates jazz, but has also, at the same time, created a jazz section for the Fringe.
That's it, yeah. I mean, it's a comedy show, but he has a band on stage. And what they do is they get lots of guest comedians, people like Jimmy Carr or Dave Gorman or the other big names that are up in Edinburgh, will turn up and do 5 minutes. But instead of doing their usual five minute act, they'll do a bit of music or they'll sing a song. Or so it's again, I see a lot of comedy throughout the year. So, I'm very jaded, I'm afraid. So it's always exciting to see something different. And this is like mixing comedy with music. It's a great, and then you get people up from the audience to do musical games and challenges. And it's just a very, there's a lot of comedy that can be offensive and a bit edgy, but this is a really great, every night it's on the Horn section, and I'd recommend it to everyone.
Edinburgh had a reputation of really making careers. Is it still the place that you can get discovered?
Yeah, I think so. I've judged the Edinburgh Comedy Awards a few times actually. And, those people, whether it's Frank Skinner going back a long time or Lee Evans, the people that have won it in recent years, or League of Gentlemen. It's kind of comedians say it doesn't matter to them, but I know that it really does matter. It's like they say they never read their reviews, and yet they seem to be able to quote lines to me, even though they say they've never read them. So yeah, I mean, there is an award in Edinburgh, and it's how you get discovered, and it just gives you a nudge. If you're great, I think you'll probably make it anyway. But it just gives you a nudge in the right direction. Eddie Izzard, Jack D. All the comedians. I think Russell Brand is probably the only comedian who didn't get discovered in Edinburgh, but he's kind of, he gets attention in other ways.
And the venues as well. It's a great atmosphere there to exercise your laughter muscles.
Yeah, and if the weather stays good, I mean, not too hot, but dry, this could be a really good summer in Edinburgh.
And talking about these sort of new concepts that are constantly sort of being brought in to debut at Edinburgh. There's one that looks interesting, Air Nadette, which is a form of air guitar, but with a full band.
Yeah.
Is that going to go down well, do you think?
Yeah, I've seen clips on YouTube, and I think this will be one of the sort of cult shows that, again, it's just a totally crowd-pleasing thing. It's like, you've got the West End musicals with, ABBA songs and, Queen songs. And this is a French production, and it also uses classic pop songs to tell a story, so you'll be sort of jumping from a song by one band to another. And as Air Nadette, as I said, it's the first air guitar band, so they're actually, but they're not just guitars, they're miming to the whole songs. Brilliantly done, very sort of tightly edited, so they mime to the dialogue as well. And I think it's unusual. It's not, it's, as I said, I'm jaded, I see a lot of 20-something men or 30-something men standing in jeans on stage telling jokes. This is a very spectacular, colourful, bright show. And I think Air Nadette, it's on at the, I'm not sure, where, Underbelly it's on. And I think it's going to be a great show to see.
Well, Bruce Dessau, thank you for joining us here on The Review, and have a great time in Edinburgh.
Thanks.
We'll be enjoying some more comedy next week when we get a roundup from this year's Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal in Canada, right here on The Review. And that brings us to the end of today's show. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Our show today was produced by Katie Bilboa and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Claire Urban.
We're handing back over to Georgina with the weekend edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget to tune in to the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at midday London time with me and Steve Bloomfield.
You've been listening to The Review with me, Gillian Tobias, and Sophie Grove. Have a great weekend.